Egg Podders, mark your calendars for Saturday, 6th of July 2024, as Egg Pod Live returns to Opera Holland Park, London, for the last Egg Pod of all, to celebrate the milestone 60th anniversary of the premiere of A Hard Day's Night, which was 6th of July 1964. Join us for another afternoon of Beatles magic and nostalgia. Special guests are Mark Lewison, the world's leading Beatles historian, and author of Tune In, The Beatles Recording Sessions, Beatles Chronicle, and many more. Eggpod favourite Samira Ahmed returns to Eggpod Live for 2024. Last year, Samira was instrumental in unearthing a previously unheard recording of the Beatles at Stowe School from 4th of April 1963, the earliest known UK live concert audio. Actor, writer and comedian Lawrence Rickard joins us. Best known for Ghosts, Horrible Histories, Yonderland and We Are Not Alone, Lawrence joins the Eggpodders to share his love for A Hard Day's Night. Stuart McConey. Stuart is a legendary radio DJ and TV presenter, writer, journalist and critic, working in the field of pop music and popular culture. And David Quantick, novelist, comedy writer and critic. David has worked as a journalist and a screen... You know who David is. So stay tuned for further guest announcements. Don't miss your chance to meet other Beatles fans, as well as the guests. Save the day for Saturday, 6th of July, 2024, and join us at Opera Holland Park, London, for a fab afternoon of A Hard Day's Night fun. Tickets are available from iamtheeggpod.com. Hello and welcome to I Am The Eggpod with me, Chris Shaw. The Eggpods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by a guitarist who, among many others, has worked with David Bowie, Robert Smith, John Lennon, Yoko Ono, the list goes on. It's Earl Slick. Hello.
Good morning. I'm good. Good to see you, Chris.
Just saying, you're looking fantastic in the sunshine in New York, is it?
It's the sun. That's what it is.
Tell me about your new book. I've got a promo copy here, but it's out the end of May, isn't it? May 30th?
Actually, that kind of looks cool. Yeah. That's the final guy there.
Oh, wow.
And with me looking really good because there's only 24.
Very sexy.
Oh, yeah.
So what drove you to writing this then?
It's one of these things that I'm sure most musicians who have worked with the likes of the Lennons and the Bowies, you know, that, I mean, my career really didn't start off as a sideman. It really wasn't my intention ever. I mean, I had my own band and we were getting ready to be signed when I got the call from Bowie. So I made an executive decision and took the gig. So that led to Lennon and all these other things that I've done. The roots all go back to David. So over the years, people asked me about writing a book and a memoirs and all that stuff. And I was always a little, I don't think I was against it. I just thought, who would read that or whatever I was thinking.
And really?
Yeah. So I had a manager that I brought on board in 2011. And she was really good at this kind of stuff. So she convinced me during the South Bank meltdown in 2012, the one Yoko curated it. And the meltdown people offered me one of the smaller theaters in there. I think it was like 500 or 1,000 seats to do what I wanted to do. And I wanted to bring David Johansen over and we could do like an acoustic blues thing, but we couldn't, the schedules couldn't work. So my manager said, what if I put together a slideshow about your career? Because I have tons of photos. We can make it from the beginning to where we're at now. Yeah. And you can just talk about yourself and maybe, you know, we could have the beginnings of an idea for a book. And I thought, yeah, why not? So I did it. And, you know, just to get like a feel for doing it and a feel for what the audience and the fans were thinking about it. And it went over really well. And there was a BBC director there, film director named Francis Whateley. He did the Bowie 5 Years films. He's done a lot of great documentaries. And I'd run into him after that, and he'd said to me, he said, you know, because I had worked with him a little bit before that on those original Bowie 5 years compilation thing that came out. He did a great job with those. He said, you know what if we did a movie about Sidemen, that, you know, instead of, you know, with a book? And I thought, you know what? And I thought about it, and, you know, time went on, kept going and going. And then at one point, it became real in 2017. So we did the movie.
Yes.
And unbeknownst to me, one of the execs at Penguin, he's a real rocker. And he was coming to the Glenn Matlock shows. And we struck up a conversation, and he'd seen the movie.
Yeah.
And he was interested in me doing a book. So, like, the book idea led to the movie, which led to actually doing the book. So the process started getting batted around about 12 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. We would do something like the book presentation we did in London, and then we'd forget about it. You know, I got busy, and then, yeah, right before the pandemic, actually, I was at the doing a run of gigs with Glenn Matlock, and that's where we got to talking about it. So that's when the decision was made to actually write the book.
Fantastic. Well, it's awesome. It's the sort of book you can keep dipping into.
It's a book is a whole another ball game than, you know, my career has spanned everything from my original little indie publishing deals to major record contracts with, you know, I was signed to probably the five big labels at one time or another in my career. And in my mind, I just looked at Penguin as a record company that sold books. You know what I mean? I don't mean that in a backwards compliment thing. I'm saying, you know, I just figured, okay, they're both doing something similar. It's recorded.
Mm.
The book is a recording of my life. The records are a recording of the music. And as the process went on, I realized it was a lot different. And, you know, and it's been easier, but much more time consuming to get what I wanted to get out of the book at the end so that I was happy and they were happy.
Absolutely.
Which I could have never accomplished that with a record company, because, you know, it's that old cowbell thing from Saturday Night Live where, you know, the record producer comes in and he's listening to a potential hit song and he's like complaining that the tambourine is too loud, you know.
More cowbell.
I didn't go through any of that with the book, thank God. No more cowbell.
So, Earl, let me take you on a little time travel back to July 1980, where John Lennon is holidaying in Bermuda and he phones Yoko to arrange some recording sessions. He's been composing all sorts of songs. So she phones the New York's Hit Factory studio and speaks to Jack Douglas. And moving on to August, 2nd and 4th of August, rehearsals take place at Apartment 71 in the Dakota.
Jack Douglas had worked with John before, and Yoko's idea was that let's get somebody we're familiar with. If we're going to get, you know, after 5 years off, let's get somebody that we know we can trust to help us with this record. So that's, and it was done at the Hit Factory, though. So originally, Jack had brought in Cheap Trick to cut some tracks, and they're great. And I think the reason that didn't happen, because it would have been a great record, was I think that it was too much. It's hard for Cheap Trick not to sound like Cheap Trick, even if Robin's not singing.
Yeah,
it's just sound, you know. So they did an about face and grabbed the usual suspects. Yeah, Huey McCracken, one of my session guitar heroes of all time. Tony Levin, I mean, you know, what can you say? Tony, Andy Newmark on drums. I mean, it was, you know what I mean? So I was, the way Jack put it when they hired me is that John already had the band together and he had all the top session guys in New York. And he wanted one guy in there that was more coming from the street that, you know, I didn't read charts, you know, basically he needed a loose cannon like himself, I guess, in a way.
Yes, you can hear it.
And
you can hear
that
it.
That was my part. So I wasn't at rehearsals. My first day experience with the whole thing was just day one of recording. whatever date that was, sometime in August, I think.
Yeah, that was the 6th of August. That was at the Hit Factory. But I think, wasn't there numerology was involved, wasn't it, in picking the band?
It could have been. I know it was later because we did Yoko's Season of Glass record in the following March from the assassination, which is only a few months later. And I know she was talking about the numerology thing. So we did all that and it went well. And, you know, it got Yoko through some of her grief. It actually helped the band because we, you know what I mean? It was almost like a memorial service that we didn't get to have.
Yes.
So it was, you know, maybe a year later, 2 years later, she wanted to make another record. So I get a call. I get a plane ticket, my hotel's booked, my gear's picked up and shipped, and then I get a phone call from the office that I'm not doing the record.
Right.
And I was like, I wasn't quite picking up on that. And then I got into more into depth and found out basically she did the numbers and something was coming up wrong.
Right.
And I respected that. What are you going to do? You know, but I tell you what, unlike anybody else, I was paid. I mean, I wasn't paid as if I would have done a whole album, but they sent me a nice check, which, you know, when you put your time on hold and every move you make in this business, it has to be somewhat calculated, you know? So most people don't appreciate that when they either change schedules or blow things out, that there are a lot of people affected by that. And obviously Yoko and, you know, the whole organization realized that. And I didn't ask for anything either. I didn't, you know, I was just, okay, it is what it is, right? But, you know, they shipped my gear back to my house and they sent me a check, which I thought was really nice. Now, I mean, a lot of times you'll get like booked to do a record, right? All of a sudden the artist has a meltdown and decides he's having writer's block and he blows it out. And you've already put the time aside a month earlier. You just fucked. You know, because... So if I've got a record that I'm going to start that I'm putting a month aside for, that's usually done months, if you know, at the earliest weeks in advance. So once you make that commitment, you're not trying to fill that time slot with another gig because you have one. So when they cancel those things last minute, you're basically kind of hung out to dry because you can't fill that time overnight. And I've never been compensated for that before other than Yoko.
Fantastic. One of the highlights of your book for me was the Season of Glass sessions. And you share some of that.
God.
It's incredible.
You know, there's something to be said about being a little bit standoffish of meeting people you admire. Because what if they're an asshole? Then what do? You've loved this guy. Like, you know, the first time I met Keith, I was terrified. I'm going, I mean, this is my favorite guitar. He's it, right? Thank God it was fine, but I thought, you know.
We should point out that it was produced initially by Phil Spector.
Yeah. I mean, fuck me. I mean, I thought, what's wrong with Phil Spector? All those hit records, that sound, you know, the Spector wall of sound and all those hit records. And we got in there and it was a goddamn nightmare. The man was out of his mind.
can you share the story?
Okay, first of all, it was March in New York, right? And that's a cold ass month.
Yes.
Very cold, you know. So we get to the Hit Factory. We did it at the same studio, same room that we did Double Fantasy in with the same band, right? And then we have Jack. And he's got the control room blacked out. No lights. All you could see is the little readouts on the machines. And the live room was dim, but it was lit. And he spoke to us in the third person through the engineer. So we're getting ready to do a take. He'll go, oh, tell the guitar player that's sitting in the brown chair to play this.
Not even your name.
No. and you know, and it's okay. And then between when you came out of the control room, you walked into a small little lounge, you know, if it's a coffee maker in there, the loo was in there. Yeah. But going to take a leak, you had to walk through that. But that was kind of like Phil's territory because every day he had this giant platter of lunch meat that he never ate, but it had to be there every day. And so that room was like no man's. And not to mention, he was walking around with a 44 Magnum pistol in a shoulder holster, one of them Clint Eastwood things.
Yeah.
And dude, John was shot 3 months ago. Are exactly. you crazy?
Yes. Yeah.
Anyway, it just went downhill from there. It was a freaking nightmare. I was so glad when he was gone.
Because Yoko, she got rid of him, didn't she, I guess?
Oh, hell yeah. I knew she was aware of it because she talked to me about it. And I was trying to, I didn't want to just jump on and start bitching when she brought it up, you know?
Yeah.
Right? I thought, okay, this is her call. She's still grieving. You know, her state of mind was not great. So I just laid off of it. So he did the elevator on the final on the first day of No Phil. And I went in the elevator with her. And I said, what time is he coming in? We didn't even say his name anymore. Yeah.
Well, he didn't say yours.
No, he didn't. You're right. I didn't think of that. And she goes, he's not coming in. He's never coming back. And I just said, okay. That was the whole conversation. There was nothing else to say. I was just going. So we finished it without a producer with the band and Yoko, and we put it together.
Yeah, great album as well. Fantastic album.
I love that record. That was a good record.
A one, a two, a one, two, three, four. This here's the story about a house husband who, you know, just has to get out of the house. He's been looking at the, you know, the kids for days and days. He's been washing the dishes and screwing around and watching Sesame Street until he's going crazy. Woke up this morning. Blues around my head. No need to ask the reason why. Went to the kitchen and lit a cigarette. Blew my worries to the sky.
Throughout 1980, you were doing the sessions. Basically, it ended up with two albums, didn't it? You've got Double Fantasy and 4 years later, Milk and Honey, which was
right.
pretty well the demos. I just wanted to really go through some of the songs with you. I mean, one of the first ones, I just want to play this bit because one of the first sessions that you did was I'm Stepping Out. And there's lots of audio now of the sessions, but I just want to play you this little bit because it quite amused me.
I think I know what you're going to do. See if I'm surprised.
Okay.
One, two, three, four. Ooh-hoo, yeah. My mama told me, put your pants on when you go out. Woke up, hold on, slick is slack. What? Well, it's not me, because I ain't playing.
That's slick as you. Oh. Just turn the nose off of Huey.
Where's Fred? Give me a fix, Fred. I'll kill you when you get here, you bastard. Give me a black one of that stuff that's in the room.
So, the sessions sounded like a great laugh.
Oh, no, that was a normal day in there. I mean, John's dark side didn't disappear after his little vacation of 5 years. But he was... What you just heard is pretty much about 95% of what happened every day.
Fantastic.
You know, he'd only go dark. I think he went dark maybe two or three times in the whole process where you could just tell something just ticked him off. And it usually had nothing to do with us. It was when we were doing, you know, with Yoko stuff. You can't put a husband and a wife in a studio together without something happening. I mean, it's just the way it is.
Absolutely, yeah. Because didn't the sessions differ? I think Jack Douglas changed, so the John sessions were at one particular time and the Yoko sessions were at another one, so they didn't sort of keep crossing paths, is that right?
I think what we would... Shit, you know what? I hadn't thought about that. I don't think there was any kind of schedule put together, per se, but, you know, the days when we were tracking Yoko stuff, that's all we did that day. And the day we tracked John's, yes, that's all we did that day. We didn't do like a Yoko song in the morning and a John song in the afternoon, no.
Our life together is so precious. Together we have grown. We have grown. Although our love is still special. Let's take a chance and fly away somewhere alone.
But I just wanted to really throw out some songs and just get your memories of it. So I guess let's start. I just like starting over, beginning of Double Fantasy. What are your memories of that?
That was one of the first things we cut. That was within the first few days. And it felt really good because I wasn't sure what to expect musically, you know? I mean, because John, right post Beatles, you know, like Imagine and those, there's a lot of dark stuff on there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, damn, how do you sleep, mother? I mean, all that stuff. So we weren't sure what to expect. And I really loved it because it just gave me that 1950s feel.
Yes.
And it was something we didn't really get to do anymore. So it was really, it was a good starting point for the record. The track was up, the lyrics were positive, and it felt like the 50s, which everybody in that room experienced.
Because in the UK, I would have been 8 or 9 years old, because I was already into the Beatles, I was reading books, and everything I read said, oh, John Lennon retired in 1975, which was sort of most of my life at the time. So I assumed I'd never hear another John Lennon record. And then they started doing stings on the radio. Oh, John Lennon's new single's coming out. I was like, what? I just completely... You must have felt the same when you got the call saying... Did you think that John had given up completely at the time?
You know, I was doing whatever I was doing in that period leading up to that when he was, you know, retired. But I didn't put a lot of thought into it. The weirdest thing was, is that when Jack had called my manager then about it, but wouldn't tell my manager who the artist was. He said, we can't have anything leaking, so blah, 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 right? So I started to think about it.
Right.
And I'm going, because, oh, of course, what are you're going to want to, if Jack Douglas calls up and he's in his own way letting you know that this is a really big fucking artist, you know, your head goes into overdrive.
Yeah.
And it was this weird thing is that Alice Cooper released a track, and I think it was called Clones. Matter of fact, I'm going to listen to that when we get off of this call to refresh my memory, that the vocal was a very reminiscent sound of John. And I remember hearing that around that time. And this is before Jack called.
Right.
And I thought, wow, did Lennon make a record? This is no bullshit, you know?
I'm a clone. I know that I'm fine. I'm running more of the way. I'm a soup doctor. He's on the line. We'll take incubation another day.
So the phone call happens. I'm racking my brain and I'm eliminating things, right? Okay, Jack's big ones. Let's think about this. Cheap Trick, I'm going, no, you can't replace anybody in that band.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
Right? Each guy, you just, you know, when the Beatles were together, you couldn't have removed any one of the four of them. It would have screwed it all up. So it wasn't them. Then I thought about Aerosmith, what Jack did. It wasn't that. And I just started eliminating all of the big bands that Jack worked with. And I finally came on with John. I finally figured it out. And I told my manager, the next time Jack calls, just throw that out there and see what the reaction was. And I was right.
Let's go again. This was, as a 9-year-old kid, I heard this as the B-side in the UK, Kiss, 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 which was, I couldn't believe what I was hearing.
That was, you know, what was cool about that was that, you know, with John's stuff, even though my basic guitar playing, I mean, every time I pick up a guitar, I'm playing, you know, 60-year-old blues things and, you know, and that kind of thing. So that's kind of where I naturally fall. But when I started working with Bowie, especially when we got to Station to Station, he pushed me to stretch out and take those blues licks and somehow twist them up a little bit, which is what we did on station.
Absolutely, yeah.
A bunch of twisted blues licks. And I thought, oh, this is cool. I'll get to go and do some stuff that's a bit more on the outside with, you know, with Yoko stuff.
It certainly is. And I love Yoko. Oddly enough, I love Yoko's stuff almost more on Milk and Honey, because you can hear things like sort of elements of, well, like proper reggae. People couldn't really do reggae at the time, but that's real reggae. And also sort of bits of B-52s and Grace Jones I also picked up as well. It must have been really interesting for you to do her songs.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there was one or two ballad kind of things that Yoko had done that were more old school traditional, but, you know, she was very much, I think she's the one that turned John on to B-52s and all that stuff, you know, because that was right up her alley. Because when we look at the B-52s and those kind of bands now, it seems tame. But back then, when they came out, that was like out there. It was very unusual for the time. And Yoko recognized that that had some value.
Yeah, it's interesting hearing John at that time talk about stuff. I mean, he was into Madness, which I find really hard to believe. And things like Lena Lovitch. And that whole new wave scene is very much more in Yoko's songs than in John's, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Treat us well. Oracle spoken. We cast the perfect spell.
Cleanup Time.
What do you remember about Cleanup Time? That's the one song on those records where my solo's live.
Wow.
We just kept it.
Cleanup Time.
Because I used to do that a lot on the songs when we were tracking them, because we didn't cut the record. As time went on, everything turned into an overdub. You overdubbed a little solo. If it was a lick, you overdub that. But the way we made the record was where he was used to making records where you played live in the room. So if the guitar solo was in the song, then you just played it while you were tracking.
Yeah, like the Beatles.
Yeah, and also the memory of that, too, is that hammer-on bass stuff that Tony Levin is doing at the beginning is like, you know,
It's fantastic. Yeah. I love, it's one of those silly little songs, but it's quite a poignant song, you know, it's lyrically. You think what they've been going through over the years, and it sounds like he's in a good place. It's weird, the album says, you know, a lot of the reviews say it's a very positive album, but there's some quite dark stuff hidden away here. But you do get the impression with this that, yeah, he's in a good place.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I love all John's dark stuff from the early days.
Yeah.
Love it. And even this, like, for instance, I'm Losing You. It's kind of dark, you know. But the way it fits in with the record and the way the band sounded and the way we played them, they didn't sound as dark as maybe some of those lyrics were, especially I'm Losing You.
Yes, very much so.
If you want to talk about dark and you go listen to Mother, I mean, that's fucking dark.
Yeah, the whole album.
You know, the guy, he's having a primal scream therapy session on an album, you know? So comparatively, this was not dark.
Yeah. Well, it starts off, doesn't it? The album starts off with a wishing bell. Ding, ding, ding. Which was like a...
And it ends with it too, because it's just like starting over, and Sean's... Beautiful Boy, both start with that.
Yes, which is direct, you know, reference to the bong, 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 the beginning of Mother. Yeah, it shows you how far they come. You mentioned guitar solos. On Give Me Something, that is an incredible guitar solo on that.
Oh my God.
It's one of the highlights of that. It's so forward thinking, real new wave sound. What sort of music were you yourself into?
At that time, I was still into what I was always into, but I had an opportunity. I put together a band with the intent of going in the direction that, you know, came naturally to me. By the time the band was put together and the demos were done and we signed with Sony, Columbia at the time, it got twisted around so much. So if you hear what I was putting out at that time, it wasn't what I was into. But I was still listening to Stones and listening to Muddy Waters, and I was listening to Buddy Guy. And you know, I was still, like I do today, listening to the same stuff since I'm 12.
Same here. The sequencing I really love on Double Fantasy, where you've got I'm Losing You and I'm Moving On, and both of these originally with Cheap Trick.
Yeah, I'm Moving On, really. That's one of my favorite tracks on that, and I love the way that it segues into it from Losing It.
They're kind of talking to each other.
Oh, yeah.
What was the atmosphere at the time? Was it positive? Because it's always portrayed as, you know, they were just like starting over. Everything was great.
It wasn't any more unusual than fighting with your wife about what you're going to eat for dinner. You know what I mean? It was that. It wasn't. Yeah. And also, there was a little bit of push-pull on the control area. Because if Yoko would speak up during John's, when we were tracking one of John's songs, that never went over very well.
Because
you know, it's that stuff. You know, it was, I'd say that 90% of the time when we're in there, it was all positive light. And then once in a while, you'd have a married couple that wanted to bicker. Business, you know, it wasn't anything weird at all.
Like any recording session ever, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I mean, a matter of fact, you know, unlike a lot of other records I've done, this one, that was smooth. The whole process. Also, because the guys that were picked between John and Jack Douglas picking the musicians, these guys were the consummate pros at the time. They were all good guys. Everybody got along. And because it wasn't a band, that eliminated all the band arguments. We didn't have to act like a band.
Yes, of course.
I never known about a band or been in a band that didn't fight, you know? But when you're in a situation like this, you're not a band. You are a band that day that you're recording. That's it. So nobody has a stake in royalties, because that's where all the crap starts most of the time, you know.
And
it's money and all that. And that didn't exist because we were hired guns that became really good friends really fast. I mean, that band gelled not just musically, but I'd say spiritually with each other. We just all got on real well.
Superb. As a band, did John mention at all about playing live in 1981?
Oh, yeah. Oh, uh-huh. The way I finished that record sessions was weird. I was living in L.A. at the time, and on the last day of recording, John came over to me and he said, look, I'm taking this out. I mean, we've already in the process of booking a tour. But the first thing we're going to do, we're going to come back in January and finish the rest of these unfinished tracks that don't go on this record, which became Milk and Honey down the line. And he said, so we're going to do that, you know, because the plan was originally to release Double Fantasy when it was released. Then the second record would have been recorded and it would have probably been released during those tour dates. So they were working on it. I have a poster.
Do you? Have you still got it here?
Yeah. It's hidden because I got a digital copy of it a while ago and printed it out, and it's in a little tube packed up. So yes, and the conversation we had is he knew I had just signed a record contract, and I said, "Well, how am I going to do this?" He says, "I will personally make the call. If you want to do this, I'll work it out." I left it with him.
Wow!
And it got worked out.
Did it? So would this have been a U.S. tour or Europe or UK?
I think what he said he wanted to do, and this is early times, because any tour I've ever been on, any major tour, they would start with an idea, and as it went along, it would expand. And it happened with David a lot. Like the last tours we did with David, reality tour was supposed to end in March of 04. But then they threw dates in all the way till July, right in the middle of the tour. So, but his original idea was he wanted to just hit every single major city. Wanted to New York, Chicago, L.A., certain other places, London, Paris. You know what I mean? So it was like amazing. It would have been.
I do remember as a kid there was stings on the radio where John would say, "We'll see you all in the 1981. We'll be playing live." And it was wow. You know, from thinking he'd retired, now this new record, and he was going to be performing live. So it would have been the Double Fantasy band, do you think?
Yeah, it would have been that band.
Do you reckon he would have augmented it at all?
No, there was no discussion about anything other than the fact that it was going to happen and it was going to be a major city tour worldwide. That's all I knew.
Wow. That's moved me well.
Close your eyes. Have no fear. The monster's gone. He's on the run.
Let's get on to your amazing acoustic guitar on Beautiful Boy, Darling Boy. Didn't you borrow John's acoustic for that?
Oh, yeah. I had my my Gibson J45 that I bought, when I was a kid. I still have it. And that was on every Bowie record, all that stuff. It was like my sort of, I'm suspicious about guitars, you know? So it was like, yeah. And it was with me. But John had this really cool big-bodied Yamaha, this black acoustic guitar with this big embossed dragon on it. I said, "Can I play that? I want to play that one." Yeah. And I played it. That's what I used on there.
Oh, it's beautiful. But those photos of it is just an astonishing-looking thing.
I wish that... You know, back then, like, even with Bowie, there were not an entourage in the studio. There were the people, the people that were working directly for John and Yoko, but it wasn't like with the Beatles where there was a photographer in the recording studio and rehearsal, every place they went. John wasn't doing that with this, and that's the only bum out of the whole time because there's really hardly any pictures from that session.
Yes.
I mean, Bob Broom was in there, and he did take a decent amount, but in the big picture, if you think about a lot of things being documented, it really wasn't that much.
Yeah. There was that footage during the rounds a while ago, If I'm Losing You, wasn't it? And it's just mainly John's guitar. But
I'm not sure if that was somehow manipulated. We were recorded. We had a film crew in there for a couple of days when we were recording I'm Losing You. And there's audio of that, but the video, anything they shot never came out. And the story was that John hated the way he looked because when we first started the record, John's hair was really long. I just think because he just decided while he was retired, he didn't bother cutting it, whatever. And he didn't like the way he looked. And apparently he destroyed the film because it wasn't digital like it is now. It was a big can with a film in it. Yes. And apparently he cut it up and flushed it down a toilet bowl or something. And I mean, you know, and people go, oh, we bet somebody has a copy. Well, if they did, it would have leaked out. It's been so long now. There's no way anybody could, you couldn't hide that film that long.
So was it sort of a pretty regimented sessions? Would it be like 9 to 5?
You know, maybe Sean came in a couple of times, you know. The hours were regimented. I mean, we were doing business hours, basically. I think we used to start at 11, 10 or 11 in the morning, and we were done 6-ish, maybe a little later on some days, you know, and Monday through Friday. I mean, it was, you know.
That's how they did Get Back as well.
Yeah, it was done. You know, that might also come from the early days that, when you did recording sessions, you know, when they went to EMI Studios before they called it Abbey Road, I mean, the engineers wore lab coats and there were guys with suits. You know what I mean? It was not like you picture things today. And basically, I mean, we were in New York and I'm, you know, I had so many friends. So after the sessions, I used to go out with Lee DiCarlo a lot, the engineer. And we go out clubbing and getting drunk and being stupid and having some fun, you know. We were the two in the band that did that. Everybody else was a lot more sane than us.
People say I'm crazy, doing what I'm doing. Well, they give me all kinds of warnings to save me from ruin. Say that I'm okay, well they look at me kinda strange. Surely you're not happy now, you no longer play the game.
One of the most beautiful songs, Watching the Wills. John's on the piano. It's quite a piano orientated song.
Yeah.
But what do you recall of that?
I didn't do much. There wasn't much to do on that track. I love that. So a matter of fact, what we did in Liverpool 2 years ago, August. It's the only time that we actually played that whole record top to bottom live with me, Tony Levin, and Andy Newmark. We hired a bunch of guys from Liverpool band and some singers. It was great, but I'm bringing this back to Watching the Wheels because there really wasn't a definitive guitar in that thing. I just came up with some parts that I did for the live shows.
Was that how you worked with Hugh McCracken then? Was it kind of because Hugh has more sort of strict regimented guitar playing? With obviously John brought you in so you could do some crazy stuff over the top. Was that how it was?
Yes and no. On the no part, when we were recording, Huey was reading charts. I couldn't read them, right? But you know, I always picked everything up. I would just listen to something once and I'd get the chords and do whatever. And Huey came up with a lot of really cool rhythm things. His would have been more jangly, and mine would have been more like Chuck Berry or Keith Richards rhythms, which you hear on some of that stuff.
Yes.
And so that was a really good compliment because he kept it. He kept that pop sensibility guitar going, and I added a little bit of grit on top of it. It was great. The only time the crazy stuff happened really was on Yoko stuff.
No, well, not so much on Yes, I'm Your Angel, but this is one of my favourite songs as well. She sounds like Marilyn Monroe on this one.
That's a great track.
I think, yeah, it was a bit too similar to Making Whoopee, wasn't it?
It was almost the same fucking thing. You know what? Everybody steals something from somewhere, man. I mean, you know.
It's very much like, yes, and...
Yeah. That wasn't done at the beginning of the sessions. It was somewhere sandwiched in the middle. And I'm guessing that we laid it down pretty quick because I don't have much memories of it. I know we took a lot of time with just like Starting Over and some of those other tracks. I'm Losing You, you know, to get the feel. We did a lot of takes. And some of them, I think some of those other tracks, they just went down on the day, like Woman and Watching the Wheels. They just kind of happened.
You described it before as very much like Here, There, and Everywhere.
Yes. That's exactly right. Now that you jog my memory, that was my first impression for the chords.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. That was my first impression.
Were you there for the mixing as well?
No, but I was at the stripped down mixing sessions that they released, I don't know, 10 years ago, whenever that was.
Yes. Yeah. Like, yeah.
Yeah. I went to a couple of those sessions with Yoko and Jack Douglas. It was weird because during those sessions, what they did, for anybody who's not familiar with that stripped down Double Fantasy, they thinned out a lot of the overdubs. They took the Elvis echo off of John's voice. And John used to double his voice all the time. And a lot of the doubles weren't there either. Mm-hmm. So when they were mixing it, I was in the mixing room with Jack Douglas and Yoko and Jay Messina, who was engineer mixing it. In the mixing room, and the only thing in the mixing room besides the console was a vocal booth. And when they were soloing John's voice with nothing on it, no echo or anything, you swear to God, I kept looking in the control in the vocal booth, thinking I was going to see a ghost in there. It was weird.
I'm just sitting here watching the wheels go round and round. I really love.
So that's what I love about that. That is the nearest to what it would have sounded like if you had played live in 81.
Yeah, or if he was just sitting in a living room playing it. You know what I mean? It was that when you got rid of the band and all you had was John's voice soloed with no treatment on it at all. It was just his voice. It was eerie. It felt like he was in the room. Yeah.
You're a beautiful boy with all your little toys. Your eyes have seen the world, though you're only 4 years old.
Beautiful Boys, Yoko's song, is really rather touching as well. It's a sort of song to Sean, John, and all men, really.
Yeah.
I think it's quite a keyboardy one, isn't it? So I guess the involvement wasn't too much, but there definitely wasn't any involvement in Dear Yoko.
Do you know the story about that?
Go for it.
Yeah. Yeah. I was absolutely trashed that day. I swear to God, if it was anybody other than John Lennon, I'm not sure. See, one thing about a backtrack, I could come in most of the time in hellacious condition and I play just as good. It didn't matter. You couldn't tell. It was always the same. And, you know, I was a kid. You can beat the shit out of yourself and function perfectly well. You know, I was so screwed. I couldn't even make it to the studio.
Oh, no. John was fine about it, though, you say.
He was all right. He was totally cool with it, man. You know, when I'm not on, that's why I'm not on that track. And I remember I'd come in. I mean, because he'd straighten his act out a lot with drugs at that time, right?
Yeah.
You know, he was on a macrobiotic diet and all this other stuff. And so he could tell when I came in really rough in the morning.
All right.
And he'd always make some kind of comment, you know, yeah, about it. But he thought it was funny. So obviously, I must have got my job done and I didn't get kicked off the record. So
your dog is beautiful.
Oh, he's a Newfie. Come here. Come here, Boo. Come on, buddy. Come on. Who's a big boy? Come on. Oh,
wow. Look at the size of him. He's huge.
Huge.
He's beautiful. What's his name?
His name is Tank.
Hello, boy. Hello.
He doesn't relate to screams like at all. All right, I'm done. Go eat.
Food'll do it.
See, this every day, usually when I do these, I do them at this time of the day and I fade him first. I keep him busy, but today he's not eating yet. He's too busy wanting to bother me.
He wants to talk about his new book.
Yeah, hey, stop it.
D-Ball. Everybody's talking, no one says a word. Everybody's making love, and no one really cares. There's Natchez in the bathroom, just below the stairs. Always something happening, and nothing going on. There's always something cooking, and nothing in the pot. They're starving back in China, so finish what you got.
Well, on that note, I think just really, because there's some great songs on Milk and Honey. I won't go through all of them, but there's such a good sound. I know it's only effectively a demo, but as a whole album, I think it works almost better as a concept album than Double Fantasy, because you've got that themed sound. Can you still listen to that album now? Do you listen to it subjectively?
When I do listen to it, it's totally objectively. I mean, I think that I really... this is what happens when you got a puppy that weighs 125 pounds.
It's a puppy. I thought he was full grown.
He's got another 6-8 months before he's even full grown. So he's getting big.
Wow, you're going to have to get a bigger house.
Yeah. You know what? No matter how big the house is, he just follows me anyway. So it doesn't really matter. Well, anyway, on Double Fish, you know what? On Milk and Honey, one of the first things we did in the Double Fantasy sessions, I think, was Nobody Told Me.
Oh, yes.
I think that was early, and I remember being disappointed that that didn't make it onto Double Fantasy. And so the idea was, is all those tracks that ended up on Milk and Honey, they were all cut in all the same sessions. There was no particular order like we did the tracks for Double Fantasy first and did those. The intent was, is to record as much material as possible, pick out the favorites, release the first album, go back in the studio, cut a few more, and finish the rest of the ones that were left over, and then put out another rep. And all those vocals, if you want to think about this too, those are live, because once we did those basic tracks, we were done in the studio. There were no overdubs. I did overdub a few things on that, one or two little bits and bobs, while we were doing all of the sessions.
Right. No, it's a great album. It's one of the, my memory of that is hearing Nobody Told Me on the radio, thinking someone has absolutely ripped off John Lennon. Because it was double whammy for me, because John Lennon had retired, then he suddenly appeared, and then what happened? And then 4 years later, someone's ripping off John Lennon. Look, he sounds so much... It is John Lennon. What the hell? You know, it's such good, amazing news at the time.
I mean, the beauty of it is that at least we got that record out, because the way we recorded, it was recorded like a band. So John played his guitar and sang just like he would have on stage on every single song.
Yes.
So that actually turned out, in light of the tragedy, at least it turned out that there was some work left over.
Oh, yeah. It's such a blessing.
It didn't disappear, because all of those songs were important to John to a degree. And, you know, after a while, even in the band, you find your favorite tunes and you end up getting married to certain songs.
Can you, you don't have to talk about it, but can you remember that night?
Yeah, I do, distinctly. It was, you know, one of these things where you're seeing something and you're looking at it, you're going, I'm not seeing what I'm seeing. It was that. I was in the West Coast at the time. Actually, I think we were getting like Christmas presents together to come to New York for the holidays. And I got a phone call from a friend of mine that said something's happened to John. He's been hurt. Is something happened? I said, what are you talking about? He goes, put the news on. So I put the news on, but nothing came up. And about maybe 10 minutes later, if that, it hit. So the broadcast originally, all the local New York news channels had it. Took about 10 minutes, and then it got everywhere. So when I saw that, the first report I saw was vague. Like, is he alive or is he not alive? What happened? And then they made the announcement, and it was devastating. It was just absolutely devastating.
Absolutely, yeah.
It messed with my head for a while. It really did.
I bet.
I think it messed with all of us, you know?
It must have been so cathartic, as you say, working on Season of Glass. How did Yoko approach you for that?
Same thing. We just got a phone call from her office. It said she was making a record, she wanted me to play on the record. That was it.
And did you all talk about it at all, or was it just left unsaid?
No, we didn't talk about it. What did happen, though, right at the beginning of the recording, which was just threw everybody off, but we had to take a few days off when Reagan got shot.
Yes,
of course. We were insane doing that record, so we had to take a few days off. I could see it in Yoko's face. And yeah, we took a couple of days off. That was the only thing. Yeah, it wasn't, the sessions were actually, they weren't morbid at all. They were fun, as much as they could be under the circumstances, because we already became friends, the previous summer. So we all had that album in common. We had the tragedy in common. And but we weren't sitting around, reminiscing and making each other cry and all that stuff. What's the point?
Exactly. Well, on a happier note, thank you for all that beautiful music. I mean, we've only talked about a couple of albums that you've worked on. You've done so much. I mean, just everybody will know who you are. Go and listen to the Bowie stuff. Listen to the Lennon stuff. I just want to thank you for all the music that you've made over the years. It means so much to so many people. And I love your book.
Thank you. I appreciate that, because the one thing that it wasn't a conscious thought until I got older was that I always looked at it like, hey, I'm in a rock and roll band. I entertain people. We go out. We have a good time. They have a good time. I make a living. I do what I'm getting paid for something that I do for free sitting around my house. And it a few things happened over the years where I went through some shit, and it'd be a record at the time, whoever's record, it would be, I would play that record because that record somehow connected with my problem at the time. Well, going through some stuff like we all do, right? And it wasn't until years later, so some of the stuff that I've done is appreciated in that way from other people, which really, it's a good payoff for me.
Brilliant.
It's a really good, if I could have played on a song that either made you dance or cry or make you happy or make you sad, then I did my job better than I thought I did. If it meant something to somebody.
It really does. But it's lovely to speak to you, man. You're a legend. Absolute legend.
I appreciate that, man.
All right.
Well, thank you.